This is KJ Live. With Chris Johnson. And Chris is having conversations with influencers in the sports world and entertainment industry. Now here's Chris Johnson.
You're now tuned in to KJ Live. Today's guest on the show is senior NBA insider for ESPN, Adrian Wojnarowski. Woj, what's good, my man?
Chris, I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Man, the weather's nice. It's supposed to be about 80-something degrees out here today, and the sun's behind me, so I'm feeling great, man. It's a beautiful day. I'm talking to you, man. Come on. This is awesome.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes. So Woj, man, I want to jump right into it. Yesterday, you reported for ESPN that Ben Simmons of the Philadelphia 76ers will not report to training camp, and he has no intentions of reporting to training camp this season or playing for the Sixers ever again. I guess the first thing that came to my mind was, but what are the pros to this type of move for Ben Simmons?
I mean, Chris, we've never really seen anything like this. This doesn't happen in the NBA. Now, we know we've seen certainly plenty of guys push their way out of a place. And sometimes you can come in and be less than committed to what's going on and make life difficult for your team and eventually get your trade. That's not what is happening here. It's just, I'm not coming. And also doing it with 4 years left on your deal, almost $150 million owed to him, $33 million this year. It's a risky strategy because you're going to likely cost yourself money. We'll see how much money. But you know, Ben Simmons has been adamant that the next time he wears an NBA uniform, it's going to be somebody other than the Sixers. And it's a little bit of a game of chicken because we know the Sixers are going to be diminished without him. They're not nearly the same team without Ben Simmons.
Sure.
I mean, forget about what happened in the Atlanta series, right? Like we know how many wins and what he's worth, certainly through the regular season.
Absolutely.
And they were a one seed last year, and seeding is going to be important, of course, in the East, which is really good this year. And so, you know, can he wait them out and get them to maybe the Sixers get off to a bad start and pressure increases to get something for him? Uh-huh. Or you're waiting out the teams who would want to trade for you to get them. Maybe they get off to a bad start and there's pressure increasing on teams that were already interested or maybe new teams to say, we better go out and do something big. We got to shake it up. We've got to improve. And then the offers get better for Simmons and maybe that gets a deal done. Or you just sit there away from the team, not getting paid, and the team takes you through February to the trade deadline. So certainly this is unlike anything we've seen. I think it's going to be fascinating how it plays out. You know, the league does not like this. It's not good for the league. I mean, if we're being honest about it, they don't want to see a precedent set with players under contract just not reporting. And I don't know that this would do that. I think this is a unique situation. I don't think this is going to be something where players are looking and going, okay, is that a strategy for me? I don't think that's going on. I do think it's kind of independent and unique, but it's definitely something we haven't seen.
I guess I'm a little taken aback just on how bad things actually got in Philadelphia to push Ben Simmons to this point. I mean, he's willing to fork over, give up $200,000+ per preseason game and all the extra sanctions on top of the league sanctions that Philly has in their organization. Woj, if you're Daryl Morey, I don't feel like he's in a good position to me, other than obviously it's a bad look for the franchise. You're top guy, but you don't have to hurry up and move this guy. You can say, you know, you're going to find him. You're going to be able to keep him and hold him. Do you think Simmons will become a locker room or chemistry issue? But he won't be around the team. So I'm just trying to figure out, how is Daryl Morey or the Sixers in a bad spot here, other than losing somebody that doesn't want to be with there?
Yeah, and I think for Daryl Morey, the hope for the Sixers was that Ben Simmons would come back and play well, and his trade stock would improve. Right. They didn't like the offers they had for him this summer. Maybe they're asking for too much, but it's really hard. And this is the other thing that's a little bit unique to the situation, Chris. You typically don't see players of this caliber being traded from contending teams. One seeds or two seeds, they're not trading their star players. They resign them. They build around them.
Yeah.
And when you see a player like, let's go back through some, you know, recent big NBA trades, whether it was a James Harden, an Anthony Davis, whomever.
Yeah.
It's teams headed toward a rebuild. They want young assets. They want picks. Philly needs to get back a star-level player to plug right in with Ben, or two really good players. And they want draft picks. And so it's harder because the teams who are trading for Ben Simmons, you know, they're trying to add them to the core they have. They're not trying to trade their best player for Ben Simmons. They're trying to trade maybe their second or third best player. And in most cases, Philly's looking at that going, well, that's a downgrade from Ben Simmons. We don't want a downgrade because we're trying to win around Joel right now, who's in his prime. Mm-hmm. That complicates this. And so you have a very short list of players who really make sense that you feel like maybe we don't win the trade, but at least we're breaking even. We have something comparable. And Ben's a unique talent. I mean, I know we talk about his what he doesn't do well a lot, but we know what he does do well, and it does impact winning.
Yeah, and we haven't seen too many 6'10 guys that see the floor, have the IQ at the level that he does, and can play the game, the floor game. Then defensively, he's a monster. Interesting stuff going on in Philly. But staying in the Eastern Conference, one of my favorite teams last year to watch was the Atlanta Hawks. I mean, I love the job that they did in the second half of the season, especially after Nate McMillan took over. I think they had the second or third best record in the NBA. Do you think that success they achieved last year, you think it's sustainable? It's going to transfer over into this year? Or was last year sort of a fluke and sort of where they peaked?
No, I do, Chris. I think we'll see a much better regular season team. Listen, they were you said it. They were definitely a better team with Nate McMillan, but they were also a more healthy team later in the year. And you've got you saw certainly Trae Young took it to another level. You saw the impact he had in the playoffs. We know what that does for a player's confidence to go do what he did in the postseason. That's going to make you just come back a better player. That just gives you great belief. It gives the group around him great belief. And then you just see what I think Travis Schlenk has done there. He's drafted really well. They've got really good role players. You know, Clint Capella, who signed an extension this summer, just such a good anchor for them defensively in the middle. You know, John Collins with a new deal. Bogdanovich, you hope for your Atlanta that he's healthy this year. Certainly he missed a lot of time. Danilo Gallinari missed a lot of time last year with an ankle injury.
Reddish, too.
And he's not really been able to get traction yet on his career, but a very talented player. And so, you know, you go down. Kevin Huerter is going to be a really good player. He's up for his rookie extension. Yeah. He played well in the postseason for them.
I guess one of my questions, though, with that, because you got a conundrum now if you're the Hawks. You paid Capella, you paid Trey, you paid John Collins. But now if you want to keep a Huerter and Reddish and you know, extend that.
You can't pay everybody.
Can't pay everybody. So
no.
What are they going to do? Like, how can they? So I guess that's my question or something that I'll be watching for is what they're going to do. That's going to be interesting because they're a very good team. And like you had mentioned with the injuries, I mean, they made it all the way to Eastern Conference Finals with guys that were banged up, hurt. And Bogey, to me, is a major X factor type. But I love the Hawks. John Collins' versatility. He really showed up and took a leap last year. Another team, Woj, I wanted to ask you about, got two of my Bruins in the backcourt, the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah.
They signed Zach LaVine in the offseason, DeMar DeRozan, Vucevic is there. Talk about your thoughts on the Bulls, Billy Donovan in that Eastern Conference this season.
Yeah, listen, certainly some more offensive weapons, you know, bringing in Lonzo Ball, bringing in DeMar DeRozan, you know, Vucevic and Zach LaVine were kind of trying to figure it out in that short window. You know, Zach went out with COVID and lost a stretch of games that kind of took Chicago out of the play-in race. And so it's certainly a different group and a more talented group. How they fit together will be interesting. I think it is a challenge for Billy Donovan. to figure out the pieces there, how they play together. Maybe it doesn't happen from day one, but that's a team that you would imagine gets better as we go next season. And, you know, certainly was put together to be in the playoffs and to be back in the postseason. And listen, I think, I'll be really interested to see how Lonzo Ball leads that team. You know, he really wanted to be with the Bulls. He had hoped that they would get a deal done at the trade deadline. They didn't quite get that done. Obviously, now Lauri Markkanen, who was a high pick for, you know, came in the Jimmy Butler trade on draft night. Obviously, he's in Cleveland now. But I think Chicago is one of the teams. They're just like when you look at that list of most interesting teams, how this thing could go. I think they might be the team with maybe the most variance. You could see where they could hit it with that group and have a lot of success. You could also look and go, do all the, will all those pieces fit together? How's that group play together? Because there's a lot of, you know, you got some young guys, you got guys later in their career. You know, early in the season last year, that was a team that played really fast with Zach. And then Vucevic comes in and the pace slows down a little bit. And then you're trying to figure out how do you balance that with two really key offensive players who play differently. So, but I think Billy Donovan, certainly an outstanding coach. They got really good leadership there. Arturis Karnišević and Mark Eversley, really good front office. And and so I do think it's going to be a fun team, certainly, to watch.
Yeah, I'm also looking forward to the development of Pat Williams. He was a really intriguing rookie.
And that's the wild card there. You said it, Chris. And, you know, young player last year, you talk to people and they'd see him in practice. And he was one of those young players who every day would do one thing where you'd go, holy cow, this guy could be. And then you saw him in summer league take a step and more aggressive. And that's what I think they want to see him is come out, like see his personality come out, see him, you know, take the initiative to do more. And so how do you balance that with Patrick Williams, with a DeMar DeRozan, who's used to, listen, having shots and scoring the ball, and and Zach LaVine, who's going to score the ball. But I think Patrick Williams, you know, a high lottery pick for them, like how that plays out, I think will be really important short term and long term, because I think there's a lot of hope that Patrick Williams is really going to that he can be a cornerstone guy for them.
Yeah, I think so. He's got all the goods, man. When you look at the job that Atlanta has done in putting pieces around Trae Young, and then you kind of juxtapose that next to the job that Dallas has done putting pieces around Luka Doncic, why do you think the Mavericks haven't surrounded Luka with the necessary parts to really put him to that Western Conference type finals type level?
Well, you look at Atlanta and so much of it for them has been hitting on the draft. Travis Schlenk came with a good reputation. They hired him. You know, it's funny. They hired, I think, Travis Schlenk in Atlanta with a thought of believing in him as a player, as an evaluator of talent. This is a guy who really grinds it on the road and, you know, is at like just has built a really good reputation in Golden State for that. And other places, comes in and really hits it in the draft, gets multiple picks and trades. You know, remember the Doncic, Trae Young draft night trade brought them another first round pick. And so, but you hit it in the late teens with John Collins. You hit it a little bit later with Kevin Huerter. And Dallas, you haven't had that draft success. And they haven't had necessarily the high picks either. But so much of Dallas, they put in the Kristaps Porzingis trade. That Porzingis was the co-star. He would be the complimentary guy. You know, an all-star level player, very unique skill set, that he'd come in and be that for Luka Doncic. He hasn't been healthy, Chris. And I think he's very talented. You saw earlier in his Knicks career where, like, this is a really skilled player.
The unicorn.
But injuries, you know, kind of those lower leg injuries have been a concern. You worry about that in a player with his frame, that 7'3". It's so I've heard good things about how he's looked this summer, and can he stay healthy? So I think that's a big part of it. And then, you know, Tim Hardaway, who, you know, ended up being much more than I thought. Listen, when they traded for Hardaway, you know, New York was getting money off and the Mavs really wanted Porzingis in that deal. And it turns out Hardaway, now they re-signed him again, and he's been such an important part for them. But I think that, you know, I think the hope for Dallas is that, you know, everyone's always talking about free agency, and they're not going to have, you know, we'll see the cap flexibility. They certainly have some. Luka's deal kicks in next year, his new Supermax, and Porzingis is on a max deal, and Hardaway's on a big deal. And so you got to hit on picks, and, you know, you got to find some guys around the edges. You know, you look at like a Utah when they bring in a Royce O'Neal, a Joe Ingles, mm-hmm. players mm-hmm. like that who are a little bit on the fringe, who come in and become starting level players, sixth men. Right. And I think the really good organizations, you get them on the cheap. And that's where your evaluation, your player development, all those things come into play when you're trying to build a contender, because you got to hit on some of those guys too.
Yeah, you do. But talking about free agency and the way the free agency will look in the future in the NBA, do you think that, you know, these big name guys, as they have been in the past, will be available for teams to sign? Will the free agent crop be as fruitful, as plentiful as it has been, just because of the nature of the way that the league is kind of shifting?
No. And, you know, Bobby Marks had a good piece, our insider, front office insider at ESPN, about that. And he and I have talked a lot about that this summer, that you look at the landscape, and earlier on in this collective bargaining agreement, you saw players doing shorter deals, keeping their freedom for free agency. I'm going to do a short deal. I'm going to keep pressure on the organization, and I'm going to keep my options open every year. And now you're seeing players, and initially that Supermax didn't seem to have the appeal to the great players in the league that the owners and front offices hoped it would, right? They wanted to incentivize players to stay where they were. So if you were with a small market team, they could pay you so much more with a Supermax, if you hit the qualifications, made all NBA or MVP and got that, you know, you turn that $170 million deal into $205 or whatever it would be. You're seeing that play out now more. And there's a little bit of an attitude. I think there's a lot of an attitude of, I will sign the Supermax now, I will fix the destination later. So if I don't like how it's going, I'll ask for a trade. But what makes less sense is go into free agency, and instead of taking the 5-year, $200 million deal that I can take with my team now, I don't know, why am I going to go do the 4-year, let's say the 140 deal that's just worthless because you don't make as much leaving as you would staying? I'll just force a trade to where I want to go. The harder part for that, though, is when you have, and you're seeing it with Ben Simmons, 4 years left on your deal. You know, Damian Lillard has 3 years left on your deal. You don't have the leverage to go where you want to go when you have a bunch of years, because anybody will trade for you when you have 3 years or 4 years left, because they know you have to play for them. Now, mm-hmm. you have 1 year left on your deal, or maybe 2 years. You're going to be, you know, maybe a small market team who would like to make a run at a big name guy says, okay, that guy's going to leave me in a year. And he's telling me, and his agent's telling me, if you trade for me, I'm gone. You're going to get nothing in return. I'm going to walk, and all the assets you gassed up to trade for me are gone. But when you got 3 or 4 years left on your deal, you can get traded. You may not like where you end up. You end up at another small market or a place that isn't better than what you have. And so I think that's also part of this dynamic.
Absolutely. Going to New York for a second, I just wanted you just to touch on the Knicks. They re-signed, D. Rose. They re-signed Nerlens Noel. They don't have a lot of space. They re-signed Julius Randle to a very favorable deal. It wasn't the max. Mitchell Robinson's coming back. He's put on 50 or 60 pounds in the offseason. Are the Knicks a legitimate threat to be a top 4 or 5 seed in the Eastern Conference?
I think they're a threat to be that, Chris, because Tom Thibodeau gets a lot out of his group in the regular season. I think the question for them is going to be, and we saw it in the postseason last year, you know, he can grind a group through the regular season. And I thought what he did last year was just really important for the organization, that it just established a baseline again of competency and professionalism. And if you were a Knicks fan, and you watch your team play every night, like, you saw something that you hadn't seen in a long time, right? They come to play every night. They can beat anybody. You know, the Knicks fans for years, like, you might as well just go to bed early when they're out on the West Coast because they're going to get drilled out West. And that wasn't the case. They're in games. They're beating people. That was really important for the organization. And that's what Tom Thibodeau brought back. And then you saw in the playoffs, they struggled to score. They struggled when you saw them against Atlanta, when Atlanta loaded up on Julius Randle and they needed other people to make shots, they struggled having enough, maybe playmakers. You know, Alec Burks comes back, who was good for them last year. You know, that will be the next step. But I think they did keep, you know, a lot of these deals this summer were really 2-year guaranteed deals. They weren't like, it was 3 years with a player team option. So they have their flexibility. I think for New York, you know, having cap space next summer doesn't really do anything. There's no big free agents. What you want to have if you're New York, you want to have picks and you want to have some young players who develop value. Emmanuel Quickly was outstanding. You know, Obi Toppin struggled in his rookie year. Certainly they were playing a lot of veterans. And then you saw in the summer and you said, okay, Obi Toppin looks like he might be ready to make, you know, that step in a guy's second year. And so you want to develop those younger players either for you to be part of your rotation to go forward, or if you're the Knicks right now, what you're waiting for is that next unhappy star who wants out, and then you have enough assets to go get him in a trade. And so I think the Knicks are trying to balance and live in both those worlds right now.
Absolutely. It's going to be interesting in that Atlantic. Going across the way, talk about the Nets. You know, came up short last year, battled through some injury stuff with their big three, made some – I consider a pretty big signing in Patty Mills during this offseason. I love Patty Mills. I love what he brings to the table on a lot of levels. What are your thoughts, though, as far as the Nets actually winning this year or being the favorites to win the championship? Are they?
They are to me, Chris. If that team is on the floor, if they're all playing and they're all healthy, I think they're the best team, and I think there's a gap between them and everybody else, even the Lakers. Milwaukee, who, you know, we saw no Kyrie. James Harden basically on one leg in that series, gutting it out. And then KD playing, you know, at an all-world level, playing like the best player in the league. Mm-hmm. Milwaukee was certainly fortunate to get out, right, and beat them. And they did.
Yeah.
And went on to win the title. But I think a Nets team with their big three, I love the addition of Patty Mills. I thought that was one of the really good under the radar signings this offseason. I think he's perfect for them. You know, Joe Harris, I think, will have a lot to come back and want to prove in the playoffs. He was really, really consistent and good for them and didn't play well in that Milwaukee series. You know, that stayed with him. He'll want to come back and he's been a really good player for them. And you've just seen, like, you know, Blake Griffin found a role there. Let's see what LaMarcus Aldridge has left coming back. But I think the Nets are the best team. As we saw last year, for many different reasons, it was rare to have all three of them on the court. And but when they're all playing together, poof, like you saw right from the beginning, Harden took on that playmaking role, played in a way that was perfect for that Nets team. We are going to feature Kevin Durant. Kevin Durant's the best player in the world. And I'm going to get him the ball everywhere on the floor to make him great. And then certainly Kyrie is as skilled of a player as there is in the league. So I think, and I thought Steve Nash was really good. I thought Steve, with a lot of different lineups, almost a different group every night, you know, there was a baseline of kind of how they played and they were competitive. I thought Steve did a really good job in his rookie year, and he's got a good staff.
Yeah.
And, they're going to be tough if they're all on the floor.
I think that's the most underrated thing about the Nets organization is that from top to bottom, that entire organization are like basketball dudes. Like my buddy Ryan Forehand Kelly, he's actually an assistant coach out there. And you talk about Jacque Vaughn, Royal Ivy, Tiago Splitter. they have an organization filled with just basketball guys. And I think that had a lot to do with the Big Three's ability to kind of buy in to Steve Nash and buy into this unselfishness. That, to me, has been the most important. And the thing that stood out the most with the Nets is their unselfishness. And they love playing with each other. They love sharing the sugar. And that was the thing I was wondering, were they going to ever be able to kind of, you know, get together? And they got it together quick. But again, the injuries are going to be, you know, the deal. Moving over to the West, Western Conference, man, I want to talk about the Lakers. They made some big signings, made a big trade, got Russell Westbrook in the building. How do you think that Russell and LeBron, two ball-dominant players, are going to fit in with each other?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, and it's not really a dynamic we've ever seen. I don't know what we compare this group with in terms of like the skill sets and say, okay, we saw it work with these guys or it didn't work. It's just a unique pairing. What I do know is that you're going to have to fit in with LeBron. You're going to have to figure out how to play with him because it's LeBron James. And the part of the greatness of LeBron is his ability to elevate the people around him, to maximize as unselfish as he is and what an incredible passer he is and how an IQ unlike any, you know, at the very, very top. He sees the game in ways that almost nobody else does. And even as LeBron loses some athleticism in his mid to late 30s, he compensates with it because he wasn't the best player in the league because he was the most athletic or the most explosive. He was the best player in the league and still certainly is right there with KD because of how he sees it, thinks it, and how skilled he is. And so he's a player who can age, who's going to age really well and still be all NBA because of that. But same with Russ. And Russ is, you know, Russ isn't the as explosive as he was in his 20s and 30s. But I think what's underestimated about Russell Westbrook is he is a great teammate. And he has got your back. He is a player who cares deeply about winning. Now, do you love every shot he takes? No, you don't. And Russ will also admit it too, and he'll do it privately with his guys when he's mm-hmm. like, but I think it'll work because Russ will be intent on it working. Now, again, part of surrounding LeBron traditionally is you surround him with shooters, right? Because he draws much attention defensively. Mm-hmm. That's not what Russ is, right? Russ is not a catch and shoot guard. He still attack the rim. And so it'll be a challenge. But I do think that, you know, and you saw Russ really come on last year. He was injured early in Washington. He played through a lot of pain and just went out and played. And you saw him as he got healthier. And then you saw that Wizards team come from really far back to get into the postseason, which was remarkable. And how he acquiesced to Brad Beal and made Brad, you know, continue to make Brad the featured guy there. I think Russ will do that in LA too.
Yeah, it's funny when you listen to the barbershop talk around here locally in LA, it's a lot of arguments going on, man, because no one seems to be able to envision a world where LeBron, like Russ has the ball. It's a late game situation. Russ has it on the ISO. His Brock, ball's in his hands, LeBron's spotting up. Because if you got it the other way around and you got LeBron with the ball, do you want Russell Westbrook's spotting up? Now, granted, they got some good pieces. They signed Kendrick Nunn, Malik Monk. I love those two. Those are two electric scorers that are going to come in and give you buckets. But again, the whole thing's going to come down to the spacing and how comfortable guys are with each other in those late game situations. We didn't even talk about Carmelo and what his role is going to be this year. But I want to get your thoughts on Melo and just what do you think his role with the Lakers? I mean, we envision a six-man type of situation, the rebirth in Portland. So I wanted to get your take on Melo this year with the Lakers.
Yeah, catch and shoot. And that's going to be his job. He'll have a lot of open shots with that group. You know, he showed in Portland he can still make him. And you saw in Portland, you know, I think it was important for Melo to finally accept the fact that he was a role player and that he was not going to be a featured player anymore. He did that in Portland. And I think he came in there humbled, grateful for that opportunity and he really helped that team. He helped them on the court, certainly. He helped them off the court. I remember talking to Neil O'Shea, their president, about, you know, all the leadership that Dame has to do day in and day out, and certainly CJ, that, you know, Melo took some pressure off of them some days because they were still the leaders. They were still their team. But Melo commands such respect of his peers, of young players. I mean, so many young players who come into the league or end up in the locker room, they grew up idolizing Melo.
Yeah.
And that he was able to help in that regard in Portland, and it was terrific in that way. And I think he can do that in LA, but he's going to need to catch and shoot. He's going to need to make shots, and he's shown he can still do that. It'll be interesting to see how many minutes a night that is for him. But this is his chance to win a championship, and he has been, it's been an elusive pursuit for him, and he has said it. This is it. This is my chance. And, you know, he and LeBron have been talking about playing each other since, I think, the ABCD camp and finding a way to play with each other. And I think, you know, I remember I've talked to Melo. I think he was on the podcast last year. I think we talked a little bit about, you know, he didn't line himself up to go to be a free agent with the big three and go to Miami. He could have maybe done that. And so this is his chance now. And so it'll be a lot of fun to see him there, see him back, in a glamour market in the NBA. Listen, he's still a player who he just has such a following. He's still such a popular player. And it's going to be a lot of fun to see him and LeBron together.
Oh, he can still get it going. And if, you know, out here in LA, everybody's expecting the championship, so it's going to be exciting. Couple more questions on the Western Conference. Two more teams. I wanted to talk about the Warriors. I had Warriors GM Bob Myers on my podcast back in March when the Warriors were sort of finishing up their season. They were actually in a good spot. Steve Kerr had sort of righted the ship. They got some wins. They were figuring things out with lesser talent. Bob was feeling great about the Warriors. They go into the summer. They draft two high lottery picks. And Kuminga being one of them that really turned it out this summer during the summer league. I guess the biggest thing, and it's everybody's question, is how is Klay going to look when he comes back after nearly 2 years off, major injuries, right? I think that's the number one thing. And then what about these other guys that they signed during the offseason? Is Otto Porter going to be a contributor? What about, you know, is Jordan Poole going to be able to make another sort of a leap? I mean, you know, Looney's there and Steph is going to be Steph, Draymond's going to be Dre, but what do you think about the Warriors? To me, I feel like that if they get hot, Klay comes back as a decent version of himself, I feel like they could surprise some people and potentially get to the Western Conference Finals. I'm going out on a limb, but what do you think about that, Woj?
Yeah, no, you said it, Chris, and the question for that team is going to be, what is Klay like? And 2 years away is a long time. And there's no more professional player than him, no more dedicated player, nobody who cares as deeply about his craft and who always puts the work in. And I know he's done that in his rehab, but there's nothing that simulates playing NBA basketball except playing NBA basketball. And so I think people have to be realistic that Ramona Shelburne at ESPN reported that they have the optimism. Maybe he's back around Christmas. And so if you're saying around the first of the year, you know, you're hoping by the playoffs that he's, you know, but maybe it takes a whole year to come back. I just think it may not be realistic to think it's just going to be the old Klay right away. That doesn't mean he can't get back there, but we just don't know. And I think that's the wild card. It all depends upon him. James Wiseman, you know, the number two pick a couple of years ago, they played much better without him than they did with him. And they when they kind of went back to the style that they were used to playing, they were more successful. Now, that's not just on him. You know, you're going to see growth. You know, obviously he had the injury, which curtailed, you know, some of his development and time on the court. But this isn't – what you're not hearing from the Warriors this year is, like, they don't want to talk about development. They're not talking about, like – they're talking about winning, and they're not using their minutes – and roles to grow young players. They're putting a team on the court that can help Steph Curry in his prime go as far as they can in the playoffs. And so you mentioned Kuminga and Moody. And I think those are two players who can be on the court as rookies and contribute and in the long run have a chance probably to be very good. But they need, you know, their mindset in Golden State this year is putting a team on the court that gives us our best chance to win every night. How does James Wiseman fit into that? What does he look like when he gets back? You know, and obviously Clay once he's back. And so that's a team, again, with a high variance. You mentioned conference finals. Realistic, I guess, if Clay is great. But we know the West is deep, and we saw what Steph did last year almost single-handedly.
Amazing.
But that's there's no one player in the West that's going to just carry you. He'll need more help, obviously.
Yeah, I think Wiggins, his performance last year, the jump he made and his consistency on both ends, I think that was a major plus for the Warriors too. I'm going to go out and say I just want him to get there because I've never been the biggest Steph fan, but I love just last year what he did, how much heart he was showing. I mean, he literally was playing for that franchise, and I could feel it when I watched the highlights. You know, it was a lot of pride associated with that, and I'm a big Klay Thompson guy, so I really wish Klay gets back to be 100%. Last one on the West, do you think the Suns can make it back to the NBA Finals?
I don't see it, Chris. And listen, what they did last year was remarkable. And what Monty Williams and Chris Paul and James Jones, that leadership to take a team, you don't see teams go from the dregs of the league, the bottom of the lottery, and all of a sudden make a jump like that. Now, Chris Paul was an important addition, and you saw the development of DeAndre Ayton and the Mikal Bridges and all those guys. There was some good fortune last year, and sometimes you need it, and that's okay. That's not a knock. You need to put yourself in position that if stuff happens to the team you're playing, that you're good enough to take advantage of it. And so they were good enough to take advantage of the Lakers' injuries. Now, they were a two seed. That's hard to do in the West. And, you know, as they move forward in the West and there are injuries in front of them and teams were beat up, and then all of a sudden Kawhi's not there in the conference final. Well, they beat the team that was there. And so I don't know if that good fortune I don't know if that carries them to another conference finals and or another NBA finals, but certainly they are formidable in the West. They're good enough to make a run. I don't feel as though they're a favorite, but they've shown that that they can take advantage of an opportunity, and that's what a lot of postseason basketball is: matchups, taking advantage of an opportunity that you don't have to be the best team to go all the way. You've got to be the team that sometimes that's healthiest, that plays together. And you get a break.
Yeah, definitely need those breaks. I think, but if you think about it, I'm just not sure when Jamal Murray's coming back. I know Kawhi is going to be out for an extended period of time from last year. So I'm just wondering about, you know, the status of them guys and how that's going to play out in the race and all that. It's going to be interesting to see because those are two major pieces in the Western Conference that's going to that are missing from teams that are going to open the door for others. You know what I'm saying?
And they change. Yeah, you're right. Jamal Murray. I think there's hope that he is back this season. I think there's some hope that Kawhi can come back this season.
Yeah.
But what do they look like when they do? Where are you in the standings when it happens? Can you make up ground? A lot of uncertainty coming off injuries like that.
Right.
But listen, we look back, and if Jamal Murray doesn't go out, nobody was playing better than the Nuggets last year.
Yeah.
And they had just made the Aaron Gordon trade.
Aaron Gordon. Oh, man. They killed the Clippers. I remember, they were smashing. They were looking good.
They were killing people. And they had a real chance. Sure you look did. Back and you go, that team could have easily have been in the NBA Finals.
Sure did.
That's sports, Chris. That's it.
Injuries, man. Injuries are everything in the league. Man, whoa, that was nice. Rundown of the NBA. I wanted to segue over into the new sort of development leagues that have popped up that are now grabbing the kids that are going to be in the NBA eventually before they go to college. The Overtime Elite League and the G League Ignite, where we saw two lottery picks get drafted from that team, Jalen Green, Jonathan Kuminga, in this most recent draft. Woj, what do you think that this new route that elite level high school basketball players can take, do you think it's going to attract more guys and take away from the bulk of the talent from the NCAA?
I don't know if it's going to take a bulk of it. It's taking a significant portion. And what I think is great, Chris, it's an option. And it may not be for everybody, but, you know, there's going to be kids who still want to go the college route and want to go to school somewhere, want to play major college basketball and all the things that do come with that. And there's kids who say, I want to go Ignite. I want to go Overtime. And that's what it's all about, is having options. Yeah. And it's not one size fits all. And I don't think it's ever going to be everybody's at this one place. I mean, there's a limited, you know, Ignite or Overtime. You know, there's limitations on how many guys they're going to bring in and pay and all sure. those things.
Sure.
But I think the Ignite last year had even more value because of the pandemic. And I think the fact that Jalen Green, Jonathan Kuminga could go in the bubble, be able to play, you know, whatever it was, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, month, in front of NBA executives, with and against NBA level talent, or certainly professional talent, with GMs there studying them, as opposed to a year where they were, nothing was interrupted. They were able to play, they're in the bubble, they're in the gym every day. Front offices could come really watch up close and see him again on an NBA court with an NBA three-point line guarding bigger, stronger, older guys. I thought that was an advantage last year for those guys, and I thought they certainly benefited from it. This year, when GMs are back in the colleges more, those guys weren't on the road as much, very little, going to the ACC or the Big 12 or the Big 10. They were limited in their travel and their access to these guys. So I thought it was even a greater benefit, the Ignite last year, for two high-level guys like that. And, you know, Brian Shaw did a great job. Now you got Jason Hart over there. I think he'll do a really good job. I think the league puts a lot of thought into who coaches the players, the support system around them. So I think the Ignite is here to stay. You know, the Overtime Elite is still new. And so, you know, we'll see how that plays out. They're certainly getting their share of really good players. And college basketball has to figure it out. And but I think what is, to me, is really good, and I think what was important to the NBA was, if I don't want to go to college basketball and I don't want to go be in the G League, and remember, the Ignite is not really, it's not the full G League experience. And the NBA knew that if we just put these guys in the G League at 18 years old and they're doing the whole G League gamut, which is, you know, 6 a.m. flight from Fort Wayne to, which, you know, to Maine,
La Crosse, Wisconsin,
bus ride back down to play the Long Island Nets, like, like, that's not for kids. The Ignite thing is a little more of a controlled environment. And agents, I don't think, Chris, the agents weren't going to let and anybody, like, because you could get eaten alive in that day-to-day G League at that age, playing against men coming right out of high school. That may not enhance your draft status. And so I think the way they've set up the Ignite is a good fit. It's not, again, just the full immersion into the G League life, which I think most kids right out of high school would really, really struggle with physically and probably a little mentally too.
Yeah, I think, but I think the most important part of the G League Ignite experience is the mentor, the mentors that the kids are around. Brian Shaw, Rod Strickland, some other guys. Now, this it was last year. Now, this year, you got Jason Hart, who is, you know, one of the very best college assistant coaches that in the NCAA, and is an 11-year pro and is all about showing this next generation how to do stuff. That's what these guys need to understand the most, is practice habits and, you know, responsibility, accountability, being grown men in a professional basketball setting. I love these two leagues. And the Overtime Elite crew is filled with guys that have NBA front office experience and NBA coaching experience. Brandon Williams, Kevin Ollie, some other guys are over there doing a hell of a job. So I'm really excited about both leagues and what the future holds. Woj, my man, last question for you. I ask this question to all of my guests. Had a great conversation with Mark Spears. He broke down a great story. I wanted you to break down or give us a great Kobe story, with Kobe being Bryant fans here, man. We just want to get your some of your best or fondest memories of an interaction or interactions with Kobe Bryant?
Yeah, I've never covered anybody like him. I'm sure I never will again. He thing about Kobe was his he had such an incredible curiosity and a desire to understand not just his industry and his world, but he wanted to understand your world, and he wanted to understand the world I competed in and understand what I would do to compete or what others would do to compete. And he understood our profession sometimes, I thought, better than some of us understood our profession. And I remember once, obviously, we know how competitive he was. And the one thing, you know, it's the relationship with Michael Jordan is really interesting. And you saw it kind of come full circle at his memorial service and Michael, how emotional Michael was. And Michael talking about sort of, you know, like a little bit early on, he saw Kobe as a little bit of like a irritant.
Yeah.
Like, leave me alone, kid. You know, a little bit of that. And Kobe wanted to. But I do remember a time where they weren't particularly close. And I remember there was a point where Michael had done some list, or Michael had in an interview had given a list of either greatest all-time players or greatest active players. I can't remember. I'd have to go back and think what it was. Whatever the list was, he left Kobe off of it, whether it was the top three of whatever. And I knew Kobe was pissed about it. And he said, where are you going to be on the road? I want to get together. I want to talk. And I'm like, well, I'll be where you, like, you tell me where to go. And he said, well, we looked at their schedule and come to Minnesota. So I got on a plane. I went to Minnesota. We go out to eat. And I remember this too. He would wear that jacket almost like it was like a varsity Letterman Laker jacket. It was the year after they had won their back-to-back. So it was the, what year would have that, Chris, been? They won the back-to-back.
03? That is what?
No, the second one with Powell.
Oh, 10 and 11?
10 and 11, right?
Yeah.
And at this point, like, LeBron's in Miami and he's about to start winning championships, and Kobe's trying to hold on to, he's trying to hold on to it. And I remember we met at the restaurant, at the hotel there across from, I think it was across from Target Center. And he had that jacket. Mm-hmm. It was like a varsity Letterman jacket. It was like a Lakers jacket. It had like the six basketballs, I think the six championship balls. And
if anybody else
was wearing that jacket, guys might've teased him. But it was Kobe, and he could wear like a – it was like a varsity Letterman Laker jacket with all the – like, you know, when a guy in high school is like a All-State and you get a patch for each All-State or for each state championship? That's what it looked like. And it was actually – it was kind of pretty neat. And so we sit down and we start talking, and I don't know if Michael came up. I do think Michael came up because now Kobe had five titles, right, and he was chasing the sixth. And that was it. And I think Kobe felt, I know he felt, if I can catch Michael in championships, that puts me in the conversation with you. You can't ever take me out of the conversation for the greatest, among the greatest players of all time. And at that point, I think people are talking, who's the best player in the league? LeBron's the best player in the league now. Maybe it's not Kobe anymore. But I think he thought, if I get that sixth title, like, LeBron's a long way from six, and the other great players in the league are all a long way from that. So we started talking about Michael, and he said to me, you know, Michael's not really the one that I emulated as much as it was Michael Jackson. And I got close, you know, I got to know Michael Jackson, and I'm going, what are you talking about? Like, I'd never heard him talk about Michael Jackson in that way. And he went on and on about getting to know Michael Jackson when he was a young player in LA and going up Neverland Ranch. Was it Neverland, right?
Yep.
And he would watch Michael make music, and he would watch his painstaking process of in the studio and how meticulous he was. And he learned about this attention to detail and how he went on and on. I'm sitting there with my tape recorder on going, maybe I've missed this, but I don't think – I remember he got up and went to the bathroom. And I remember I Googled Michael Jackson and Kobe. I remember sitting in my seat going, has he talked about this before? And I look and I'm like, I don't see it anywhere. And I'm going, all right. And so I ended up writing the piece, and it got a lot of attention at the time because he had never. And then, of course, The only thing I remember finding was, I think Kobe was at Michael Jackson's memorial service, and maybe they did a quick TV stand-up with him, and he talked about him. But what the interview really was about was, it was a dig at Michael Jordan. What the whole thing was really about was, like, you know what, Michael, you're not even really my guy. Now, we know Michael Jordan was his guy, and like, yeah, I knew it was bullshit, and he knew it was bullshit. And the Michael Jackson story was real, and he had done and spent all this time with him. But it was the lengths Kobe would go to sort of give a dig back to Jordan without, like, just, it was elaborate. And the Michael Jackson stuff was all accurate, but it was just really, I don't know if he really wanted to talk about the Michael Jackson stuff as much as it was a way to tell Michael Jordan, well, like, you know what, if you're not going to put me on a list, maybe you're not really my, it just was great. And it was Kobe. And I just, it just was a little window into how he thinks and how competitive he was. And there's just nobody else like him.
Man, absolutely genius. This guy was basically like, to MJ, to Michael, you're not the MJ that I looked up to. I looked up to this MJ,
buddy.
That's
exactly what it
was. Wow. That's a big time story. A big time story. Well, Woj, thank you so much, my man, for joining KJ Live today. We'll be watching you on ESPN. Do what you do. I'm sorry I kept you so long, man. I know you
can.
Okay, good. All right, good, man.
Chris. We'll catch up soon, my friend.
Yeah, we definitely will. Thank you so much for joining. This is KJ Live with Adrian Wojnarowski.